yeah, I could listen to that kind of music all day long. Lou Donaldson on alto sax. His response, I would say, to yesterday's Joe's Blues by Johnny Hodges and Wild Bill Davis. Today we hear Lou Donaldson's Lou's Blues. I like this. It's from his first, it's the first cut from his 1959 album, The Time Is Right. Horace Bunn on piano, Blue Mitchell on trumpet, Lamon Jackson on bass, Dave Bailey on drums, and one of my everlasting faves, Ray Barretto on congas. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trice Lead. And we pick up from where we left off yesterday. And it might make a little, it might make you a little bit uncomfortable, but that's what I do. I was born to make people uncomfortable because we had to flesh out certain things, and this is what analysis is. You have to dispense with the emotion of things and almost force yourself into a whole different dimension where you see things for what they are. All right? You just dispense with all the things that would make you mad and all the things that would make you happy, and all the emotionalism of it is to be thrown right out the window. And what we are looking at would be the hard reality. And that gives us an incredible insight into how we are to view our world and how do we navigate within these dimensions that we are now appreciating in a different way. You see, the political formula is, well, I'm a Democrat. What the heck does that mean? And you think like a Democrat and you act like a Democrat and you follow the leadership of the Democrats. Well, I'm a Republican. That means I necessarily must be conservative. God and country. And I have a greater appreciation for the philosophy of, do it yourself. Government is not a parent. Government is a method or system by which we get things done, ostensibly in the interest of the whole group. But I want my little piece, of course, because I belong to a group that has a distinct set of values. And we've been through this dynamic for, I mean, how long now? The time has certainly come to reappraise our understanding of political life. And I am raising this with the backdrop, of course, of Donald Trump's State of the Union message tonight, his real first State of the Union message, because as we discussed yesterday, his first state, what would have been the first State of the Union message, occurred just a mere couple of weeks into his administration. And just right after his inauguration. So he had nothing really to tout in terms of his own personal accomplishments and accomplishments of his administration. So now a year has passed, a very tumultuous year. And what I want to do today is to encourage us to move away from this fixation. And it is a fixation, and I mean, we can't help it. It's just the way things are working out because Trump himself has inculcated in the entire country and in much of the world a fixation about him, about his way of doing things. So we are riveted by the personality-driven politics of our day. However, it also gives us the opportunity. By fixating on Trump, we ignore the real issues that we ought to be dealing with. And we transfer, it's in reverse, we are transferring onto Trump responsibility for a whole bunch of things that have nothing to do with him, that have everything to do with us. And in a particular way. All right, so I'm going to ask you today to kind of put a little bit of distance between yourselves and this phenomenon known as Donald Trump, in terms of, you know, people just, well, we hate him, we don't like him. Okay, we get that. But instead, look more clinically at where we are on the political timeline. This kinder, gentler, chastened Trump will be telling the nation and much of the world a whole bunch of things tonight. But we shouldn't fixate on that, because after all, this is politics. And politics is about what works. What gets me to the end zone? And we instead have to now ask some questions, and I think that this is stuff I've been talking about for a long time. We are kind of clear, I think. We have a very good idea of Trump's, for lack of a better term, political philosophy, his political base and the philosophy of the political base. We have some kind of idea about what basically blew him into orbit. How did he get there in the stratosphere of politics? And most importantly, the question is, and it's going to be a little dicey for us, but we have to deal with it. What is Trump doing right? You got that question? What is Trump doing right? Or you may choose to address it from the flip side of the question. Why hasn't the opposition not figured out yet what it's doing wrong? That's a more intriguing question, isn't it? Forget Trump as a great phenomenon and all of that kind of stuff. Politics is politics. Somebody's going to have to win. Somebody's going to have to lose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We get that. But this is not an ordinary time. This is not just another changing of the guard, is it? There have been radical changes that have occurred and still are occurring right before our eyes. And in as much as people, you know, say they can't stand him, we have to acknowledge a ton of people love him and support him. And for a man with little or no previous political prowess, we have to admit, however grudgingly, however unwillingly, that Donald Trump and the Trump phenomenon has been quite significant. Is it because he's that good? Was it because we're that bad? You take your pick. But what I want us to understand is not really to get into affixing blame one way or the other, but in understanding how and why things have unfolded the way they have and why they are likely to continue on that trajectory. This is important because the left, if I could use that term, has completely absolved itself from any responsibility for the rise of Donald Trump. It has no accounting to do for the fact that Donald Trump is president. And it continues to persuade us, the people, the broader community, that we should think like that. As an astute political scientist, or I should say, as astute political scientists, we ought to see that we cannot and should not excuse the left. They have a direct bearing on the dilemma that we now supposedly share. You may disagree with that premise, but this is what we are required, I think, to do. Because if we don't do it, we simply will be in permanent reactive mode, looking to the guy who blazed through all of this and rose to the top and brought along with him a whole bunch of things that we can't tolerate. The rise of the racist elements in our society, a meanness, a whole redefinition, it's autocratic actually, a redefinition of what democracy is. All these things are not just his doing. And this is the kind of discussion we ought to have. How did the left facilitate the rise of a Donald Trump? And even now, how is the left responding to the fact that it doesn't have the upper hand? Where does that put us? Okay, we have our work cut out for us today. We have to do these kinds of things. It's dialectical discussions in which we take things apart. We don't affix blame and say, well, you did this and you did that. We have to say, this happened under your watch. To what degree are you responsible? What didn't you do? What haven't you done? And what can you still do to really aggressively represent your constituencies? This is the question. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Remember, we're just trying to get a handle in understanding this phenomenon. And it is. A guy comes from nowhere, really. I mean, he's brash, he's obnoxious and all of that kind of stuff. Great. But he's always been that. How did it happen? Not necessarily it was because he's so brilliant, although we can't deny that you have to have some kind of brilliance to have pulled this off. But we're looking instead at side of the Trump's achievement, stunning victory within the context of the abrogation of political science on the part of people who supposedly understand how this works. They not only lost ground, they lost momentum, they lost control, they lost even contact. How do you wage a political war when you are so strapped for weapons? And this by your own doing, in large measure. All right. So that's the lay of the land for today. And I'm hoping that we can have some brave souls walk us through this, thinking this through. Is it that we find ourselves in perpetual reaction to Trump and Trump-like politics? Or is there something else that needs to happen here? What are you thinking? 888-874-4888. Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about political analysis is that there's no free lunch. Nobody gets away. Everybody has to account for what they're doing. Everybody has to account for what they're doing and also for what they're not doing. Because in the end, it's a contest, isn't it? For turf, for power, for the fidelity of people who you can count on to help brace a party or a movement in its quest to achieve a political objective or a series of political objectives. This is the game. We can't continue. The worst thing that we can do right now in the state that we're in is to continue that of saying they are doing something wrong. We are okay because we are protesting. No. Nobody gets away. So to what degree do you ascribe to the opponents of this administration, the political apparatus that is supposedly countervailing this administration? What is it that that movement or those, why are they to be held accountable as well for this outcome? And it's not a part of a discussion. And that's, to me, a sad thing. Because if anything we need to learn from this experience, it's going to be with us for a long time. Make no mistake about the significance of Trump's election. And that it literally divides political time between BC and AD. The Trump phenomenon we see now all over Europe and in many other parts of the world. What is it? What is this formula? What has been the bedrock? What has driven this kind of candidate and this kind of thinking forward? And to what degree have the traditional opposition, has the traditional opposition fallen down on the job? Can it recoup? What does it have to do to recoup? All right. Okay. So we'll take this little break, give you a time to put your brain cells together and come back and get into our discussion right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We're almost halfway through the program. And indications are that there's a reticence about our discussion today. And I expected that, which is why I'm asking the questions. We have a very hard time disassembling the propaganda that is directed at us. We actually believe the propaganda that we are in opposition. Okay, where is it? What is the mechanism? What is the turnaround in our political thought? The people driving our political thought on the opposition side are still playing the same old game. One part says, that would be Trump. The Trump contingent will have its set of beliefs and objectives. And then the other side comes up with a set of beliefs and objectives. There has been no real definitive change, either in tactics or in content, ideological content, of the opposition. They're just telling us the same thing in this time. Trump is evil, Trump is bad. Okay, we get that. Trump is evil, Trump is bad. The whole Trump administration across the board, it should be condemned. But what is the definitive change in our political ideology? What is the definitive change in the tactics of the opposition? And whether they choose to admit it or not, whether we choose to admit it or not, we're stuck. And we're stuck in reactive mode, not proactive mode. That's my belief. Oh, I just got a note saying that we seem to be having phone issues. But we'll proceed. But you understand what I'm saying? Considering the severity of what we told, this is a severe turn. Trump, as a political phenomenon, has fired up a massive resistance, a massive support for things that we relegated to the right wing, the people who are coming out of the dark ages of politics, they're in charge now. Okay, get that. I get that. Fine. I'm not concerned about that. In the sense that people would think, I'm not obsessed about it. Whether it comes now or it comes 2 years from now or 20 years from now, it is on track to come to us that way. It is inevitable that we will see this kind of political manifestation if you study politics. I am concerned, however, that we are not having the kinds of conversations we ought to be having on the flip side of the coin. We have very little to show for a dramatic, like that expresses a dramatic parting away from the norm, which is you make a lot of noise, you show up, lots of protesting, whatever. What is informing that? And we simply can't be content with the idea that we just have to say no to Donald Trump. That is not a sophisticated response. All right, let me ask Nerve Central. Have our phone issues been okay or still having trouble? Okay, we are still having trouble with our phone system. That's such a downer, but we will continue. But do you understand? It is time to demand from the opposition at all levels. It's time to demand a different response, a different answer, a different approach, because we have to admit we lost. We have to admit it. And there's nothing wrong with that in the sense that, you know, who's to say you have a guarantee of monopoly on anything? No, you don't, not in politics. The work that the Trump camp has done to educate its supporters and would-be supporters about the vested interests that they have in supporting this administration, supporting this Trump and his policies, has been phenomenal. We may not like it. In fact, we may vigorously object to it. But that is not important. The fact is, it's a done deal. And they did it, let's remember, in record time. They were able to marshal that latent power, that power that had gone to sleep, at least many people thought it had gone to sleep. Many people didn't even know it was there in such intensity. But Trump understood. I mean, he's new to this game. And the first order of priorities is to win. You got to win. He won. And he's still continuing to win. Look at all the negatives against him. Look at all of that. And people are still strongly in support of this administration. It's a very sad thing, in my view, but it is a real thing, which is the more important thing to understand. It's a real thing. White supremacy has reared again its ugly head. It's a real thing. It doesn't go away. When you're talking, you know, well, we'll be protesting, and it doesn't change that. It doesn't reverse that. The idea of the stratification of classes that we have not seen in quite a while in this country, it's real. It doesn't go away because you stand up and say, well, you know, the administration is racist. Well, and are you trying to tell me that there is no racism in the progressive world, no racism in the radical world? It is. It's there. I've talked about it. So they don't have a more solid footing than anybody else. They have the same contradictions. And I want to see, I want to hear from people. Our phones are really giving us a problem today. And, you know, let's blame Trump, okay? Let's go with the flow. Blame Trump. Trump disabled our phones. But the idea is, these are the discussions we need to be having. It is not enough to continue with a simplistic, in my view, a simplistic response to a very complex problem. Nor should we be so naive as to think that the opposition, that's us, is in any way a better choice in terms of how it's going about things than Trump. We will be talking theoretically. When the evidence suggests that the opposition blew its currency away, it misspent its currency. It disregarded, it showed the same disregard as the establishment for the people it should be supporting and whose needs and concerns it should be championing. It moved away from its constituency, developed a level of contempt predicated on the view that people have no place else to go. We're it. So you might as well throw your lot in with us. The black community is a flat surface. You know, it's a flat surface. It's the same racist interpretation that the other side had, the Democratic Party had for its side. The Democratic Party ceased to be relevant to the struggles of the day and to the needs of the people. It isolated itself, it insulated itself against the people, and only on occasions when they needed a strategic advantage did they come to the people. The Democratic Party ceased to be. It ceased to yield a hefty return on the investment. And so people said, who needs it? As they correctly should. Even now, we see that with the advent of Trump, we're seeing protests all over the place, which is good. It means that there's an awakening of consciousness. But it is not directed consciousness. It is having all of the signals of people just establishing their own little niches of power or influence. But there isn't an ideological premise for what they're doing. You have the women's issue, you know, all that is fine. But what is the ideological foundation of your political action? If there is none, then there's no point, is it? You see. So now I think we ought to see massive efforts to look internally at our own contradictions, because we are continuing the same pattern of making a huge investment without understanding where the hell we're going. what we're doing. What is the end game? What is informing the decision? And we look and we see the same stratification in the middle of all of this new development of political power. It's still white controlled. They haven't moved away from that. They're still stuck with the idea that themselves first. We are taking care of our interest first. So we have contradictions and class within these new movements that are springing up. We have no articulated new ideology, new philosophy informing our actions, which makes us, we're just functioning on ether. We have no real solid plan. We have nothing that informs our. I want to give you an example here. I just want to reiterate also, our phones are still not working. But we would likely not be able to talk to each other today. But at least you could listen when we come back to each other and are able to talk to each other. These are the things I want to talk about. You look at movements, and I want to raise an example here. The Garvey movement. The movement spawned by the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Now, here is a man. He was not an extraordinarily educated man in the sense of, you know, he has a PhD in this and an MS and that, and it wasn't like that. He was very clear, however, that for lack of a better term, a constituency existed that was at extreme disadvantage in just about every sense of the word. He started in Harlem to bring people together, but not willy-nilly. It was not one of those feel-good plans. You know, get together and talk about white America and the white people all over the world who are doing people of color in all over the world. That was not his approach. He understood he had to articulate an ideology that would guide every aspect of the movement, whether it's economics, education, and so forth. He had a plan. He had several plans, as a matter of fact. And he put it on paper. This was what you are supposed to understand, not only about your own condition and why you're in this condition, but you are to understand, A, who the culprits are in creating your condition, and more importantly, what you can do and what you must do to overcome their plans for you, so that you can not just survive, but you can thrive. Incredible. Incredible. Very sophisticated political thinking and understanding here. It is not just about pointing at people and say, you're doing me wrong. No, they say, well, we know you're doing us wrong, but we're minding our own business and we're taking care of things that are well within our control that can turn this thing around for us. We don't care what you do. We know what you're going to do. We know what you have done, and it is likely you will continue on that path. Fine. Now, you see, that's extraordinary to me. That's extraordinary thinking. And right out of Harlem, we had the world's largest political, economic, and economic movement coming right out of Harlem, reshaping, recreating brand new realities on the ground, which is a thing, but more so in the minds of people about the possibilities of how, as an individual, you improve your lot with an elevated consciousness. If you have a coming together of people of like mind, there you go. You have a serious political movement. We have no ideology today. What is the ideology of the opposition? What is it that the opposition believes? We have no belief system articulated. We go with the flow. We deal with things when they crop up the best we can. But even when they deal with things, they're not dealing with things equally. The needs of the people of the United States who are at political and economic and even social disadvantage do not rank high within the Democratic Party. And even with the Green Party, for that matter. We're concerned about the gap between rich and poor. Bernie Sanders says it all the time. What is the ideology that informs, in your view, the right way to go, informs the action plan? They won't say. Is it socialism? Is it communism? Communism? Is it some kind of ism that has an articulated set of beliefs? We don't have that. They make it up as they go. But all these years, now in the case of the Democratic Party, we're talking a lot. A lot of years. I will be kind and just go from, say, the 1950s. Okay? The stratification within the party has remained exactly the same over all those years. It was a white-led party with white Southern sentiments and ideologies. Remember, the Democratic Party was the party of the Klan. It didn't, it practiced a kinder, softer, gentler form of trenchant, impervious racism, but it existed. And people were led to believe that the party is really trying to do the right thing. No, it's not. Even if it's trying to do the right thing, we have to concede that given the benefit of time and doubt, it has failed spectacularly when it comes to the needs and the priorities of the vast majority of people who have been loyal to the party. No question about it. Right now, when we had the crisis in Puerto Rico, when we have the crisis in education, when we have major problems that we're dealing with that are consistent with, these are consistent experiences with the vast majority of the Democratic Party's so-called constituency. What are people doing? They're waiting for Nancy Pelosi to tell them what to do and how to vote and if to vote. You see, we haven't really punished the party for maintaining political apartheid in this country. Even within left of center movements, we see the unwillingness of so-called radical people to literally overturn those old ways of white dominance. They're very unwilling to do it. And we kind of indulge in a sense of make believe that we say, well, you're espousing so-called radical ideas, so you must be a better kind of person. This must be a better kind of system, but it isn't. The lesson here from Donald Trump and his administration is that what we are seeing and experiencing is not just happenstance. It's not accidental. And we also should come to the conclusion that our haphazard response also is not accidental. Because the systems that have presented themselves as alternatives to the status quo are themselves riddled with contradictions that they refuse to admit. They refuse to acknowledge. They refuse to say, we are not ready to engage. We are not ready to engage with the system. And in very basic ways, when you consider that in recent decades, the possibility was made very clear that it was right within our grasp to turn things around politically. We had people coming together under a shared umbrella of concern with more progressive ideas, and more than that, with a commitment, because they were in the streets, they were marching. They were participating. What did the leadership do with that? How much ground have we lost? Because these movements and their leaderships refused to articulate not just a new vision. I think they did a good job of articulating the possibility of a new way of life politically. But the contradictions remained, and people allowed it. People allowed it. They overlooked it because progressives and radical people can't be racist. They can't be sexist. You know. They are different. Well, take a look. And you tell me, when our phones are up, maybe tomorrow, you tell me whether we are missing an opportunity here. And this, I think, is precisely the time we have to do this, to examine the many ways in which we blew it. We blew it. It's not so much that Trump won, it is that we lost. And we lost for the same reasons that in previous years people have lost. The reasons for our loss, our political losses, they haven't changed. We lost. And we have to admit that. But beyond admitting it, we have now to call to account why it is that we continue to repeat these awful problems. Why do we continue to repeat the same thing and we can't see it? Why is Nancy Pelosi telling people who are elected from places like Harlem and New Orleans and Washington, D.C., how they should vote, when the people elected go to Washington and accomplish a particular set of missions that they're supposed to do? They're supposed to be on mission, not Democratic Party mission. And the party is not, has not invested in that process. The party has not invested in the process of championing their constituencies' rights and needs. They now have selected to place themselves on a political plantation, which is where most of our problems derive. They're not following. They don't particularly care to know what you want. That's what the Nancy Pelosi's of the world are there for. They will tell you what you want and when you will want it and how you will want it. And everybody says, yes, ma'am. So you see, we have problems. We have what the Haitians call problème. A big time problem. And we better get to honestly appraising our problems and trying to find an honest way. I know I just said a bad word, honest. We have to try and find a realistic way of redesigning our politics. Outside of mainstream politics, we have to show something that suggests we are in touch with the evolution of politics in the United States, that the needs of people have changed dramatically. So why is it that the response is constant and the same? So this is what I advise we do. Get over the hump. Trump has won. But we should understand why he win. Not that he's not supposed to win. I mean, it's a free country. People want to run for office. They run. But it is important to understand Trump as a phenomenon in the sense that all of the predictable barriers were shot to hell, and he came barreling through. What were the component parts of that victory? What sustained what most people were saying as an impossible candidacy? It was just done for, public relations or grandstanding or egomaniacal problems. But that's not it. We are lying when we oversimplify the Trump phenomenon. And we are lying because by necessity, if we were honest about it, we will have to examine the opposition. And the question then becomes, it's not why Trump won. It's why we lost, and whether we will continue down that track of having no articulated ideology. We have no political foundation. We're not moving in a progressive way. We still have the plantation society. We're still on the white political plantation. And run, by the way, not even by competent people. We're still hostages. We'll see each other tomorrow, and we'll be talking, hopefully, with our phones up. Bye-bye.